As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. If it's a sports story you're talking about, you can guarantee they'll be talking about it. Unless it's something like arena football. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet Magazine. Lots to get to today. Raptors lose after coming off a pretty good Western road trip. They're now 2-2 without DeMar DeRozan. Great crowd last night and some big celebs in attendance for that Nelson Mandela tribute as well. Maple Leafs back in action tonight. They host the Vancouver Canucks. Surprising Vancouver Canucks. Depends on who you talk to about that. But I think most people would say they're surprising. Things are kind of up and down in Alberta as far as the hockey teams are concerned. One of them really up. One of them has press conferences because they're so bad. We'll get to all that coming up in the next couple of hours. But let's start with those Toronto Blue Jays. The Major League Baseball winter meetings start on Monday in sunny San Diego. And yes, you can feel jealous about the people going down there because one of them is in studio with us right now. Ben Nicholson-Smith is going to go to sunny San Diego tomorrow. We all hate you, Ben.
That's okay. That's fair. I'll take the trade-off.
All right. Okay, yeah, you'll take our scorn as long as you get to go to sunny San Diego. I like saying sunny San Diego as well, more than I realized. So Blue Jays have been one of the more active teams already this offseason, Ben. You've got the Brett Laurie trade for Josh Donaldson and, of course, Russell Martin signing. Now they pick up a left fielder, Michael Saunders, because they wanted to get those three Canadian starters into the lineup for opening day. Jay Happ headed the other way to Seattle to the Mariners. Ends the Melky Cabrera era in Toronto. What's your overall take on this deal?
So I think if you look at it as Melky versus Saunders, it's a downgrade. There's no question about
Clearly.
That. Especially 2014 Melky, who had a fantastic season. I don't think that Saunders can be expected to match that. But at the same time, you look at what Saunders can do, and he's a guy who offers some power, some defense. You know, there's a little bit of upside there offensively as far as getting on base. And I think that the total package for the price of, you know, call it $3 million compared to Melky, who's maybe asking for 4 or 5 years, I can definitely see why the Blue Jays went there. And I think Saunders is going to be a solid player for Toronto.
Ryan, does the fact that he's Canadian affect you at all as a Blue Jay guy? Like, people going down to the ballpark, I think there is something to be said about Russell Martin being Quebecois and speaking French. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Blue Jay signed a 6-year deal with TVA slightly, days after the signing of Russell Martin. But the fact that they replenished their Canucks with now three, as I mentioned, going into opening day, projected to be in the starting lineup with Russell Martin and Dalton Pompey in center field. Does that affect the average paying Blue Jays fan?
I think it's more just like a cherry on top. Like, I think ultimately, you ask any Blue Jays fan, they're not going to care if it's a team of people from all over the world, everywhere except Canada. If the team is going to win the World Series, they are going to be all smiles. But yeah, I mean, I think it probably adds just a little tinge of excitement. And, you know, it's kind of one of those things where I don't think you go out with a mandate to find Canadians. However, it's, you know, if just say for the sake of argument in, at the draft, the Blue Jays have two guys who are equal, you know, if you can pick someone from Canada and, you know, fire up the juices of the crowd a little bit, then why not? But I certainly don't see it as a prerequisite to stoking the fires of the fans to have a lot of Canadians.
I think it probably affected the Russell Martin signing as well. Clearly, the Blue Jays offered him the longest term and the most money. But I think all things being equal, He would have probably chosen the Blue Jays over somebody else, Ben.
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, it's funny. He was asked why he chose to come to Toronto, and I think it was either the first or the second thing that he said was they offered the longest term. They offered the best contract, which is great. I mean, that's honest. That's what players signed for. But at the same time, like you said, hey, this is a team that he watched growing up. I mean, he grew up in Montreal, but he watched both the Expos and the Blue Jays at that time. You know, 92, 93, they were very much on his radar. It's amazing how many players will cite Joe Carter's home run as one of their big childhood memories now, the guys who are in the big leagues, and I think Russell Martin would be among them.
I don't think Russell Martin's doing his press conference in French if he's re-signing in Pittsburgh. No. Probably not. So back to Michael Saunders. Peter Gammons on Twitter, I retweeted this the other day, talking to a lot of GMs. I mean, Peter Gammons, one of the best in the business, talking about a lot of executives talking about this Michael Saunders deal being one of the more underrated, underappreciated pickups of the offseason so far. Now, not a lot has gone down this offseason yet, but you talk about the on-base skills of Saunders. If he can reproduce what he did in limited action last year, Ben, because he only played 78 games, here's another thing about this guy, is that he is proven to be brittle at times, and last year was one of those times, and maybe that's what soured the Mariners on him. But in 78 games, very productive. Hit .273 with a .341 on base and slugged .450. He did it. He had a 19 homer season in 2012 as well. Maybe there is something in that bat, and especially when you talk about leaving Seattle and moving to the hitter's haven that Rogers Center is. His away splits have been very good throughout his career.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. When you look at the jump from Safeco Field, and this could apply to Justin Smoke too, but you look at going from Seattle to Toronto, especially as a guy who has some power, this is a ballpark that really favors guys who have some sort of power, especially guys from the right side, so that doesn't apply to Saunders or really Smoke, even though he's a switch hitter. But you look at this park as something that can really bring out the best in a power bat. I think that's one more reason to be encouraged by what Saunders can do.
A lot of people are joking about the fact that anytime you can go grab 2 9ths of the Seattle Mariners offense, you have to go out and do it. The Mariners haven't exactly been an offensive powerhouse. They've been pretty dreadful offensively, and they're trying to redo that offense this offseason with the signing of Nelson Cruz and apparently hot and heavy on Melky Cabrera as well. Now, we're not 100% sure where Smoke fits in, but they did non-tender him, then sign him for $1 million. And there is that DH slot, and I guess a lot of it comes down to Deonor Navarro and if they're able to move him. But it is kind of curious that you're trying to improve your offense and you go out and get Seattle Mariners. That doesn't necessarily make sense on the face of it, Ben.
I agree. But at the same time, you're getting, like you said, 2 9ths of their offense. You're paying a total of, call it, $4 million. The guarantee is so low. You do have other options. So it's not as though you're acquiring these guys and saying, well, they're going to go on the side of the stadium and they're going to be on the front of our pocket schedule. They're pieces. And in baseball, you just need so many pieces. These guys are going to be among the many players the Blue Jays rely on, and I don't really see a problem with that.
So mentioned that this spells the end of the Melky Cabrera tenure in Toronto. Now, Alex Anthopoulos did leave the door slightly ajar, said we would never say we're 100% out on Melky, but it makes less than no sense now for the Blue Jays to be in on Melky. They've moved past, and it seems like they gave Cabrera's representatives a timeline, a deadline, and they stuck to it. They were unable to sign him, so they went out and filled that slot in left field. Now, Ryan, as Blue Jays fans look at this offseason, they look at, you know, the payroll parameters, right? They blew their brains out to go get Russell Martin, overpaid maybe, to go get him, but he's one of the best defensive catchers in all of baseball. Is there a message to be sent here, though, that they were unable to go get Melky, or is it just a situation where that money is probably better spent other places? How should Blue Jays fans be looking at the fact that they're moving on from Melky Cabrera?
I definitely don't think in any sports context you can approach things with, oh, they didn't spend the money, then they weren't trying hard enough. You know, I mean, you've got to be fiscally prudent. I know perhaps less so in baseball without a salary cap, but no, I mean, I think, you know, they've obviously got a long-term plan, and with someone like Cabrera, maybe they just don't want, you know, maybe the term doesn't fit, you know, maybe the dollars on a shorter term deal they think is all right, but they just don't want to commit to him for that long. They don't know how he's going to hold up. So no, I don't think you can look at it and say, oh, you know, they're clearly not invested enough. I mean, it's in a context where they saw you know, sometimes you got to overspend in whatever sport. Sometimes you just have to say, you know what, we're going to eat it on the back end. And we think Russell Martin is going to bring so much to us in this area, in this area, in this area, that we are happy to say when he's, you know, really on the back nine, you know, we're happy to carry him for a couple years.
Yeah.
So that shows you that they're not, it's not all just bottom line driven. It's just, you know, they identify what areas, what positions they're willing to do that, or what guy they're willing to do that. And it was Martin.
Yeah, I think the guy part is the big aspect, because these weren't positions that they needed to fill. Catcher and third base, left field they did with the departure of Melky Cabrera. But it's been a kind of a weird way about going about it, I think, Ben, this offseason, that they did go address third base and catcher. Maybe third base you could understand with the fragility, I guess, of Brett Laurie, but that came completely out of nowhere. And anytime you can get a guy who's been up there, you know, his name can be next to Mike Trout when you're talking about war over the last couple of years, that's probably a move you got to go out and do. But there were more pressing needs on this team. Second base is still a question mark. The bullpen's still a question mark. They haven't done that.
Exactly. And I think that when you look at this offseason, what we've seen so far, in a sense, especially compared to last season, we've had a full offseason's worth of drama and excitement and action. But when you look at it, it's not a complete offseason. They still have such glaring holes. You look at the bullpen, especially after trading Nolan, Graveman, moving Happ, that really shifts around the pitching staff. You're really looking thin in the bullpen right now. And then at second base, too, I know they went out and added Devin Travis, but I think that there's a very compelling case to be made that you need to get someone, even if it's for 1 year, who can give you everyday caliber production at second base.
This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Ben Nicholson-Smith and Ryan Dixon of Sportsnet Magazine. Major League Baseball winter meetings starting up on Monday in San Diego. So remember that Ben Nicholson-Smith is there when it's like minus 50 and snowing on Monday. He's drinking pina coladas with Alex Anthopoulos. So you mentioned how this rejigs the bullpen and the rotation, the fact that J Happ is gone, and maybe you're dealing him at the peak of his value. He had a pretty good season last year, some really good starts, and fastball was up to 95 out of nowhere. So I think this directly affects Aaron Sanchez, Ben.
Definitely. I mean, you look at their rotation as it projects right now, he's the number five. And I think the Blue Jays want to give him every opportunity to go into spring training and win that number five starting job. So maybe he can do that. Maybe his secondary stuff isn't quite as evolved as they would like it to be, but he is going to get that shot. Now, I don't know what you guys think about this, but I would probably, if I'm the Blue Jays, feel more comfortable going into the season if you have a couple other contingencies, especially with the way that they've traded Nolan and Graveman and Happ. I don't know if you want Estrada and Sanchez to be your only options, because injuries happen, bad performances happen. You know, I wonder if that's something they look at.
I guess Redmond could step in there, make a spot start or two.
Norris.
And then Norris is percolating in AAA as well. But these are unknowns. Like, as much as great as Aaron Sanchez was in the bullpen last year, he was outstanding, right? I mean, who throws a 99-mile-an-hour sinker ball? Not a lot of dudes. But you wonder how that translates to the starting role, because his minor league starting numbers they don't jump off the page at you at all. A lot of control problems. And you mentioned the secondary stuff. There's questions about his breaking ball. You know, when you're coming out of the bullpen, you can throw 99 with sink and guys are seeing you for the first time. You can get by with that. It's hard to go six innings throwing nothing but 99-mile-an-hour sinker balls. First of all, you don't necessarily throw 99 for six innings. Probably going to tone it back just a little bit. But it could be a question mark for Sanchez. I don't think it's a given that he steps into that role and performs.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that you look at the stuff and the velocity. So I think that even if he doesn't end up developing the secondary pitches that you would hope, he's got a very high floor. I mean, you look at Shelby Miller with the Cardinals. He's a one-pitch guy. He throws a fastball. He has had some pretty good results, and he was just traded for Jason Hayward. So if that's what becomes of Aaron Sanchez, I don't think that that's bad. I think that's one potentially good outcome for the Blue Jays, but he does have the ceiling to be even more than that.
Mentioned the bullpen. The Blue Jays apparently, like all 30 teams in Major League Baseball were in on Andrew Miller. He finally signs with the New York Yankees. David Robertson's still out there, and who knows, maybe the Yankees bring them both back. Dylan Betances is spectacular. Miller's kind of just only done it for 1 year, though, so it's a big-time gamble if you're talking about giving him a four-year deal for close to $10 million per, which is what the Yankees gave him. So what do the Blue Jays do now with this bullpen? I was surprised. Shai Davidi wrote a couple of weeks ago about the fact that they're not completely out on Casey Jansen. I mean, that it seemed like fait accompli that he was going to take off and go somewhere else. I mean, is that a guy you could see back in a Blue Jays uniform next year?
Personally, I can't see it happening.
Yeah.
I can't. And even if no one is going to come out and say that there's zero chance of that occurring, I don't see it happening. I think that at this point, you try to look around for some free agents. Trade options obviously would be in play as well, but maybe you look at a guy like Jason Grilli. Maybe you look at Rafael Soriano, Francisco Rodriguez, see if there's a deal to be had. But I also think you want to be ready to wait, because sometimes the best relief deals are out there in January, and I know that wouldn't appease, you know, some impatient fans, but you've got to be prepared, I think, to be patient.
How important is it for this team to go get a quote-unquote closer? Do you believe in that? Because there are some guys, and, you know, a lot of managers. I think John Gibbons actually is one of these managers that says, you know, it's not just anybody you can throw back there and close out a game. You got to have some sort of mentality. And it gets back to the analytics conversation you have with people and whether clutch exists. But can you just be a good reliever and step into a closer's role? We've seen it happen occasionally. And you know what? We have seen guys struggle in that role. Do the Blue Jays need to go out and get a guy who's done it before, like Rafael Soriano, although he lost his closer's job this past year in Washington? Or a K-Rod who has, you know, he's done it in the past. Is it imperative the Blue Jays go out and do that?
No, I don't think so in the least. I mean, you want a designated closer, I think. Otherwise, it just amounts to so much of a distraction, not only for the media and the fans, but for the players themselves. I think if you can get someone who is that guy, great. But I don't think that player has to have 530 save seasons on his resume right now. I mean, look at the best relievers in Major League Baseball last year. You have Greg Holland, Wade Davis. Wade Davis was a failed starter like 12 months ago.
Yeah.
And Greg Holland 2 years ago hadn't established himself to this level. Craig Kimbrell was a draft pick, and then he came up and they gave him a shot as a rookie, and he's been a dominant closer ever since. I mean, Chapman was supposed to be a starter. David Robertson was a setup man for the longest time, and then he became a closer. I think that if you have the stuff to close, then that's great. And part of that stuff, I would acknowledge, is a mental component. But you don't have to be, you know, this isn't a job that you have to have tons of experience in to succeed at. You can succeed as a relative newcomer.
You just need a good walk-up song, right? Like, you need a good closer song.
Was that Hoffman? What did Hoffman have? Hell's Bells.
Yeah, Hell's Bells.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Speaking of San Diego, Trevor Hoffman.
It comes back to San Diego.
Yeah, it always does. Mariano Rivera with the greatest walk-up music of all time as far as relievers are concerned. Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Ryan, you look at this offense now. Certainly 1-5, it's scary as hell, man. Jose Reyes, Josh Donaldson, Jose Bautista, Edwin Encarnacion. You got Russell Martin in there. And then you have to, I mean, the bottom half might be a bit of a question mark, especially, I don't know, depending on what you get out of Michael Saunders' bat and who's second base. But should Blue Jays fans be excited about that top four? I mean, does it compete with just about anybody else in Major League Baseball?
Yeah, I was probably talking to Ben about this at work this week. Like, you know, it's getting toward murderer's row a little bit, I would say. I mean, especially if you see, you know, Bautista's obviously had some injuries up and down. But, I mean, if he has another big year, yeah, that's a tough one to navigate. So, I mean, certainly, as you said, on the top half, it's hard to imagine the Jays are going to have much trouble pushing some runs across. It's just going to be, you know, as we've touched on, it's going to be a matter of how many the other team gets, especially in the late innings.
Ben, are you surprised that Alex Anthopoulos pretty much handed this starting left fielder's job to Michael Saunders, even against lefties? Wouldn't you like to see maybe Kevin Pillar get a shot occasionally against the occasional lefty? Or is that kind of implied that he's not actually going to start 162 games in left field?
I think Pillar will get a shot. I mean, I think that with injuries around baseball, and it happens with every team. So I think that Pilar will get his shot. But no, I think that it's fine to give Saunders everyday playing time. He showed that, you know, you look at his numbers in terms of home runs, wins above replacement. He's consistently been on the 1 to 2.5 range. I mean, that's fine. It's not going to be necessarily an all-star, but he's a guy that can be a solid player, and that's all they need.
And defense is a big part of this as well. You go back to a season ago, the Baltimore Orioles had a pretty similar starting staff to the Blue Jays as far as advanced numbers, and make of that what you will, but their like xFIPs were almost identical. But the Blue Jays starters' ERA was almost a run higher, and you can account to you can point to defense as maybe the sole reason between that discrepancy. Now, a big part of it is shortstop. Now, Jose Reyes isn't going to be J.J. Hardy, but they lost a lot with Brett Laurie missing a bunch of time last year. And as much as Melky Cabrera was moving around a whole lot better than he was when he had something growing on his spine, he's not exactly, you know, Gold Glover in left field. And Colby Rasmus, I think, had a very down defensive year last year. And Jose Bautista, as much as you want to say his arm is spectacular, he's not an above-average defender either. But now, if you go into this season with Dalton Pompey in center field, we've seen what he can do with the glove. Looks spectacular. And you've got Saunders in left field, a center fielder playing left field, and Donaldson at third base. How much have the Blue Jays gone and addressed that defensive issue that they had a year ago?
I think they have. And Donaldson and Russell Martin, I think, are huge parts of that.
Yeah.
You know, Martin's receiving, his throwing, both definitely above average. And I think that's going to have a big impact on the pitching staff. You know, you mentioned the Orioles, and I think that last year, Hardy and Scope up the middle. I mean, looking at them turning double plays, Scope on that turn is just quick release. I don't think the Blue Jays have that. I mean, they're not going to compete with Reyes, and whether it's Travis or Meiser. I mean, you're not going to have that same quickness, that same ranginess and arm strength that the Orioles had. I mean, they had the full package. So up the middle on the infield, I think that's going to be one area where the Blue Jays, you know, are really going to have to prove their doubters wrong. Mm-hmm. And I would probably count myself among those doubters at this stage.
One of the subjects that's come up in the last couple of weeks, and I guess it comes up quite often in the offseason, is the issue of the turf. They're getting new turf. Shai wrote a story about how they're, you know, getting some different turf that's not going to be flattened, apparently, because it's not as heavy when they fold it on itself. That was a big issue with the turf in the past, where the stuff all got, and the fake grass got flattened on itself. So this is going to be a new turf installed this year. And I guess we're still looking at 2018 being the point at which they look at installing real grass into the Rogers Center. Ryan, you've been down there. We've all been down there. Do you think your experience would change a little bit if you were looking down on a nice summer's day and you saw real grass, or does it not matter to you?
I think you got to go a little farther than just the turf. You know,
I think Rogers Center is a little underrated, though.
Really?
As far as a baseball venue, when you get a good crowd in there on a nice summer day.
You know what? I will kind of grant you that. I do know what you're saying a bit. Obviously, roof open. You know, it's just the problem is the contrast, right? There's just so many ballparks out there that are spectacular, right? So it's, you know, it's tough. It has some tough competition. But you're right. We probably do gloss over that it can be, you know, it's, you know, you've got the CN Tower right there. You do have some pretty good vistas on a good day. But, yeah, I mean, real grass, I'm sure, would help. But, you know, I don't think anyone's going to mistake it for Camden Yards anytime soon.
Yeah, Brett Laurie mentioned that maybe that was one of the reasons he suffered so many oblique injuries. I don't think you can blame Rogers Center turf for falling into a camera well in the Bronx. But you look at, and then there was the story a couple of weeks ago about Melky Cabrera would prefer to go somewhere else so he didn't have to play on the turf. You see this every offseason, and who knows, countless free agents that refused to come to Toronto because of the turf. Carlos Beltran might have been the case a couple of years ago when he signed that free agent deal. It wasn't that long ago that there was, I don't know, 10, 11, 12 ballparks in Major League Baseball that had artificial surfaces. Now it's just two. It's Toronto and Tampa. Is it overblown? Is it a real thing?
I think ultimately money is going to be the top one. I mean, you look at Russell Martin. I didn't hear him say one word about the turf when he signed.
Well, he has to stand on dirt, though. That's right.
He's got to pass.
Still, I don't know. I think that if the Blue Jays were spending more aggressively, and by the way, there are lots of good reasons not to spend, you know, 7, 8, 9 year deals on some of these free agents who might be past their prime. But, you know, I think that really it's going to come down to money. Turf is a factor. There's no question, especially for the guys who play here every day. I think it creates a lot of wear and tear on their bodies in the course of a 6 month season. There's no question about that in my mind. But, you know, we've seen some of the Blue Jays players able to overcome that. I mean, Batista, you mentioned him.
Yep.
And he's a fanatic about his fitness. He takes great care of himself. And I think that that's enabled him to play a 6 month season last year, although he has had his injury issues in the past as well.
Ryan, now you got me jacked up thinking about some sort of Camden Yards, like on Lake Ontario, some splash down in right field. How amazing would that be?
A new ballpark and good transit in Toronto would be, could you imagine?
Take one at a time.
The
here.
Value, like the quality of life in this city would just improve 200%.
View of the skyline.
Yeah, amazing. Oh, yeah.
So you're not a fan of the shuttle buses that are running today?
I'm not a fan of the bus that didn't pick me up today because it runs on a different schedule on the weekend, apparently, so yeah, I had to walk.
I rode the shuttle bus.
Yeah.
It was grand.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not fun. I miss the city. There's a lot of parts of the city I miss living out in the burbs as I do now. That, not exactly one of them. When we come back, talk a little Raptors. They fall to the Cleveland Cavaliers 105-91 at Air Canada Center yesterday, and mention how everything's coming up. Ben Nicholson-Smith, he was at that game because he gets to go to Raptor games that are tough tickets, and he gets to go to sunny San Diego in the middle of winter. Is there reason to be concerned after that loss to the Raptors? We'll talk about that. Also, the fact that the Raptors now 2-2 without DeMar DeRozan, and Lou Williams kind of falling back down to earth a little bit. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis with Ben Nicholson-Smith and Ryan Dixon on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
A taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet magazine. Here's Dan Robson.
Anze Kopitar is probably the most underrated superstar in the NHL today. The King centerman has been one of the game's most consistent two-way forwards since joining the league. But despite leading LA to 2 Stanley Cups, he's never won an independent award. Still, Kopitar is receiving praise from high places, like Wayne Gretzky high.
I think Anze Kopitar right now is third best player in the National Hockey League, only behind Crosby and Taves, and he's getting better every game.
That was the great one on Hockey Night in Canada last year, when Kopitar was leading the Kings to his second Stanley Cup in 3 years. And when Gretzky talks, you listen. So recently, I went to LA to learn more about Slovenia's favorite son. How did a guy from a nation with just 6 rinks and a little more than 200 registered hockey players become one of the most respected centermen in the NHL? Well, it was a family effort, one rooted in a humble start and local dreams. A boy who just wanted to play like his father, but eventually became more than either could imagine. He went on to become the first Slovenian to win the Stanley Cup, and when he returned home to share it, more than 10,000 showed up and pretended to hoist it with him. They all know the story of this future Hall of Famer very well. It's probably time that we learned about Anze Kopitar, too.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet magazine, available on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Ben Nicholson-Smith. Raptors fall to 15-5. The sky is falling after a 105-91 loss to the Cleveland Cavaliers. Don't look now, but the Cavs coming on strong now. 6 straight wins gets them to 11-7. It's actually a better start than the first year the Big Three in Miami had. Granted, they've had moments where they haven't looked great, and the schedule's been a little soft recently, save for yesterday. Raptors are a good team. The night before, they beat the New York Knicks just barely, a 4-win New York Knicks team. But take nothing away from the Cavs, playing some pretty good basketball right now, and they're a good offensive club. Were again yesterday. Kevin Love hits his first 3 threes of the game, went 0 for 5 the rest of the way. But LeBron James, you almost didn't notice him. And he came 3 rebounds short of a triple-double, 24, 13, and 7 for LBJ. And the Raptors just didn't have it going on offensively. And we're talking about the best offensive club in the NBA as far as point scoring is concerned. Everything's coming up Ben Nicholson-Smith these days. He's going to San Diego tomorrow for the winter meetings. He was at, I guess, the game of the year for the Raptors, although that game against Chicago on TNT was a pretty tough ticket as well. But Ben, yesterday must have been fun as well.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I mean, the fans were really into it. Lots of basketball royalty in the house as well. And I guess it's too bad for the Raptors. They weren't able to actually capitalize and really impress in front of the big crowd.
Yeah, you had Magic Johnson, Charles Barkley. T-Mac got a standing ovation. Did you stand for T-Mac?
Most definitely, yeah.
Yeah, T-Mac was there as part of the 20th anniversary of the Toronto Raptors. But a lot of those guys, yeah, in attendance as part of the tribute to Nelson Mandela that happened before the game. Masai Ujiri organizing that, and just a great moment for the Raptors organization with all those big celebrities in attendance. Unfortunately, they do come away with the 105-91 loss. But that being said, they're 2-2 without their, I want to say their best player, but I don't know. It's kind of a toss-up between DeMar DeRozan and Kyle Lowry. And Lowry certainly seems to be the heartbeat of this team. And they've missed DeRozan, no question. They've scored without him, so it's not fair to say that they've really missed a whole bunch of offense without DeMar DeRozan. Yes, I know they only scored 91 yesterday, and the offense didn't look great. But in the three games out west, the offense did look pretty good. They went 2-1 against the Lakers, the Jazz, and who am I forgetting?
Sacramento?
And Sacramento. But they only scored 91 yesterday. So 2-2 without DeMar DeRozan. I don't know. Are there any takeaways from that? Should the Raptors, is there any tinkering that needs to be done? Are they satisfied with 2-2 without DeMar DeRozan, Ryan?
Well, I mean, what do you think, big picture, what record do you think they're aiming for if he's gone for a month?
Well, that's the thing, right? They've got a really tough stretch coming up at the end of December where they go on the road to Chicago, the Clippers, Denver, Portland, Golden State, Phoenix. That's murderous.
Right.
Over the World Junior Hockey Championships. So that's going to be tough. But in the meantime, before that, I mean, they got Denver at home on Monday, and Denver's no great shakes. They still play in the Eastern Conference, right? They've got games against the Pacers, who are not great. The Knicks are horrible. Magic, they've handled this year. Brooklyn, Detroit. They've got very winnable games. And yes, it's fair to say that that's a big reason they're 15-5. But it's not like they're not going to, you know, be transferred to the Western Conference tomorrow. They still get to play the Eastern Conference. So sure, yeah, you know what? The Cleveland Cavaliers play in the Eastern Conference as well. They're not 15-5.
Yeah, and I mean, because I think people feel like the Raps record is a touch inflated because they haven't had the strongest competition so far. When you're sitting at 15-5, I think you've got to feel like if we go 500, especially given the tough stretch that you mentioned, with our guy out of the lineup, they'll probably take that. Maybe a little better than 500. So at 2-2, the small sample size, I think they're shrugging their shoulders and saying, you know what? Could be better. Could be worse. And, you know, so far, so okay without DeRozan.
And I think that they're still very well positioned. And part of that is just the amazing start that they got off to. And at the time, they seemed unstoppable. What's going to get in the way of DeRozan and Lowry and everything that was going right for the Raptors? Now, that obviously hasn't been sustained, but I think that, you know, you mentioned, Ben, having the Eastern Conference schedule, that is going to help them over the course of the full season. That's going to allow them the chance to rest guys when they need to and really endure stretches like this where one of their top players is out.
Yeah, and Kyle Lowry has been great. Overall in the four games without DeMar DeRozan, was 7 of 18 yesterday, not spectacular, with 22. Amir Johnson kind of carried the offensive load with 27 points on 11 of 15 shooting, but overall, Raptors didn't have much going on offensively, shooting just over 40%. There's a lot of talk. Whenever you talk about the Raptors this year, I think one of the underlying issues, one of the underlying talking points, is the buzz. And I mentioned it. The first thing talking about the Raptors was, what was it like? What did it feel like down there? It's another sold-out crowd, over 20,000 in attendance to watch LeBron James. It was a tough ticket, and I know people who went down there paid almost playoff-level prices for tickets on the secondary market. It was an exciting game, and I don't know. We talked about this a little bit before we started today, Ryan. I don't know if it'll ever be a tougher ticket than the Maple Leafs. But can you imagine a Leaf game with as much buzz as the Raptors have had now twice? That Chicago game and yesterday for LeBron James' first return to Toronto as a Cleveland Cavalier.
Yeah, and I think buzz is the right word because it sort of hums throughout the game, right? Like Leaf games, even I was there on Tuesday when they got off to a great start. They basically were all over Dallas from the start. And it's still just really quiet in there at times. Whereas the Raptors, I find throughout the whole game, as long as things are close, as long as, it's a contested game, there's noise.
And you can't say, oh, it's because Raptors are more accessible, the ticket prices are cheaper. No, they're not. They're not. So that's not a reason. You can't say, well, it's only the elite of the elite go to these Leaf games and they're eating sushi and they're paying $700 a ticket. Raptor prices are very similar. So I don't think that's a fair comparison at all.
No, it just seems like it's maybe the game lends itself better to it. I'm not sure, but it just seems like the in-game operations, it's just livelier. There's no doubt. It's more, there's more of a beat, no doubt about it. And I just can't think of too many times that I've been at a Raps game, even in recent years when they weren't so hot, where, maybe if they were losing by 20, but other than that, there just isn't a lot of dead spots in the game.
And I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that the Raptors have built up so much goodwill with their fans.
Yeah, how did they do that?
I don't know.
The Leafs do that?
They should give the Leafs a crash course, I think.
Keep saluting the fans? I don't know. Like, why is that? It's been so quick, right? I know overall Raptor fans have been loud and boisterous, even when they were lousy. But, were they that boisterous when they were tanking? When they were a couple of games under 500, they traded away Rudy Gay, and it looked like it was an all-out effort to get Andrew Wiggins. It's a complete 180 from that point last season. How did they do it? Honestly.
I mean, a lot of it would have to come down to Masai Ujiri and what he's been able to do as far as putting a talented team on the court. And that's, I think, a big part of where it stems from. You look at the frustration that Leafs fans have with their team. I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that for a long time they weren't in the playoffs and they made it, got knocked out in painful fashion, missed again. I mean, I think that if you have a team that is 15-5, that's considered a potential Eastern Conference favorite, along with the Cavaliers and maybe a couple other clubs, then that's going to go a long way toward creating energy in the crowd and really giving it that buzz that we're talking about.
What do you guys think gets deemed a successful season for the Raptors? What do you think they have to do for people to walk away and say, I'm happy with that?
Well, I think the goalposts are changing almost week to week, because going into the season, I think it was, finish fourth, fifth, win a first round series. If not win, at least get to a seventh game of a first round series. But probably you want to win it because you already got to a seventh game last year with Brooklyn, and then anything in the second round probably gravy. But now that they're leading the Eastern Conference again, we're pretty early in the season, but that they have steamrolled the lesser lights, that they've gone toe to toe with some of the good teams, they've beaten the Memphises of the world, they've beaten some Western Conference opponents. I think if you're not in the Eastern Conference final, or at least very close to the Eastern Conference final, isn't that almost a disappointment now for this team?
Wow. I would put the over-under a little more accessible than that. I would say you want to win one series, and then you want to get to a seventh game of a second series. Mm-hmm. And that's the tipping point for me. That's the over-under as far as success or not success.
I guess if you're just doing like baby steps, just getting to a second round series would be,
they have to win a playoff series, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if you call it disastrous, but it's a pretty tough pill for this team and the fans to swallow, especially after last year, if they get to the playoffs. Because I mean, if you finish in the top three in the East, you might be playing a team that's under 500.
Oh, definitely.
Man, you better win that series.
Yeah. Right now the Raptors, well, I don't know if this is good or bad. If the playoffs started today, they'd have a rematch against the Nets. But that's not exactly that same Brooklyn Nets team of a year ago. They're 8-10 this season. But yeah, it's going to be maybe Miami, maybe Milwaukee, Orlando's the ninth team in the Eastern Conference. So I mean, we're talking about a team that's not exactly a powerhouse. One of those top four teams is going to be heavily favored in that first round of the playoffs. So you would say anything short of an appearance in that second round would be a big disappointment for the Raptors. But a lot's still to play out, and DeMar DeRozan probably going to return in about a month's time. We'll have a lot bigger sample size of which to work with for the Raptors when he gets back. When we get back, we will talk a little Maple Leafs, who have a little all-Canadian affair going on down at the Air Canada Centre, which you can hear on Sportsnet 590 The Fan starting at 5 o'clock with Hockey Nation. They got the Vancouver Canucks in town, who are quite good. And maybe it shouldn't be a surprise, but it is maybe a surprise to me that you go through two good goalies, run them out of town, and now you got a third. Not a lot of teams can do that. The Edmonton Oilers can't even get one. You've had three in your organization in the last couple of years. Ryan Miller off to a pretty good start wins-wise, and the Canucks, pretty good team. Maple Leafs coming off that loss against the Devils. Talk a little Leafs coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon, Ben Nicholson-Smith on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
The top topics, the headiest headlines, the debatiest debate. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Ben Nicholson-Smith. Maple Leafs hockey coming your way on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Hockey Nation gets you started at 5 o'clock. And then it's the Maple Leafs and Vancouver Canucks down at the ACC after 7 o'clock on CBC as well. Hockey night in Canada. Maple Leafs had been playing some pretty good hockey lately, and I guess, you know, you can just call that loss to the Devils on Thursday maybe a bump in the road, but snaps a streak of four straight wins on home ice. Four straight games in which they had to salute the fans. Didn't have to on Thursday because they lost 5-3. They had a streak of five straight games in which they earned at least a point as well, which was impressive. Trying to start another one tonight against a very good Vancouver Canucks team. Ryan, overall, you look at this Leafs team, I think it's pretty much where you expected it to be in one of those wild card spots, but man, it's been a circuitous route to get here, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's the Leafs, right? I mean, they, whether micro or macro, they're kind of Jekyll and Hyde, but yeah, you said it. I mean, the last couple years, it's a team that people have thought, well, you know, they could compete for the wild card for one of the final playoff spots, and lo and behold, there they are. So you're right. I mean, obviously, when you have back-to-back outrageous losses, one to a Buffalo team that at that time was shaping up to be historically awful, and then, you know, you follow that up by getting drubbed on home ice where they've had some gruesome moments in the last handful of years, you know, things are pretty bad. But, you know, when you look at it, that happened all in the span of about 4 days. You know, sometimes things just get away on you. The Leafs were playing pretty well before that, if you recall. The night before they went into Buffalo and got hammered, they played Pittsburgh really tight, but yep, they had lost. But they had a couple good wins before that.
Three straight before the Pittsburgh loss.
So really, you know, you wipe off, 4 days there, and it's now been a pretty good stretch where they've shown you some things. I mean, I think the takeaways from this team are pretty clear relative to the last couple of years. There's just a little more balance up front. The bottom six, you've got guys out there whose primary job is to be useful hockey players. It's not to go around and beat people up, and that's going to make a big difference, right? So
no more face punchers.
No more, you know, not ones whose sole job it is anyway. Yeah. So, I think, and we can delve into this if we want later, but they have a top line that line's going to get some goals. There's good players on that team.
You were about to say rivals anybody's in the National Hockey League, weren't you?
Well, I don't know if I was going to go that far, but it's what are they going to get from everything else? And when you have a second line that is anchored by Nazem Kadri, who's you know, still in the grand scheme of things, pretty young, coming along. You know, we were talking about the low risk investments that they made. You know, it's one thing to go into the offseason and make a few moves that you have to go into October praying that they work out and that there's going to be a big swing built on. But when you do a bunch of smaller things like sign David Booth, sign Santarelli, bring back Komarov, bring in Daniel Winnick, you know, there was a pretty good chance a lot of those little moves were going to pay off. And lo and behold, they have so far. So you add it up and, you know, what Toronto's been striving for or should be striving for is just a little bit more of, you know, some even performances. Because even as bad as things have seemed at times in the past couple of years, no one has ever said, oh, the Leafs have no talent. There is talent on the team. It's just a matter of filling in a lot of those holes, and I think they're working toward doing that.
It's not just about winning with this team, though, apparently, and especially in these new Halcyon analytics years, the National Hockey League. You can't just win. You have to look good doing it. Your Corsi numbers have to be good. And you know what? Save for the New Jersey game, and you know what? They started to get a little bit away from it in the Dallas game. They looked really good. It wasn't just the wins that came against Tampa, Detroit, and the OT loss against Pittsburgh, win against Washington. Ben, they actually looked, you know, like a team that was controlling the puck and wasn't just getting outshot by 500 shots and then scoring on the rush opportunities. They actually looked like a pretty good hockey team.
Exactly, and that's a pretty rare thing for a team that really didn't have great puck possession numbers for the last little while. So to see them controlling the puck probably is a really good thing for this team, secondary to wins, of course, but it's an encouraging development. And I wonder, maybe that comes down to the fact that they have guys like Booth and Santarelli really rounding out their entire rotation of forwards, so you don't have one line where you're just going to get nothing.
Yeah. Are you one of these guys, Ryan? Because I know I am. I don't just look at wins now. Like, I almost have to analyze the game two ways. There's the result, and you hear even Randy Carlyle talking about it occasionally post-game. He said, you know, it's hard to criticize a win too much because a win's a win, but yeah, we're starting to get away from our game. And I guess the lessons are learned from a year ago. Ben mentioned it. You know, they were winning a whole bunch of games at the beginning of the season. People said, this is unsustainable. And they said, ah, shut up. And then it was unsustainable. Do you analyze it in two different ways when the Maple Leafs win a hockey game?
I think you'd be foolish not to look a little deeper than wins. And you get whatever league, but, you know, right now you can look around the NHL, look at the Leafs' rivals, the Canadiens. You know, they were a team that got off to a tremendous start, but they were bottom third in terms of giving up shots and shots taken. So, you know, people were saying, well, we'll see where this goes. And lo and behold, I think they've lost 5 of 6. And obviously another team that's coming through here on Tuesday.
Their goal differential is one. Leafs have a better goal differential. The Leafs have a +7. The Habs have outscored their opponents by one goal this season.
Yeah, so there you go. So, yes, I think you do have to drill down. And obviously we all live here in Toronto, and the Maple Leafs dominate the talk, and they've been essentially the poster boys for the, you know, what's going on in the world of analytics, because for the past couple of years, yes, they've been one of the teams that has been consistently been outshot, yet still managed to be, you know, they were a playoff team in the shortened season and were very, very close to being a playoff team last year. So, yeah, there's just too many examples. You know, you look at Colorado. They never went off the rails last year. However, they lost in the first round. Now this year they're really having a tough time, and they were a team that everyone, you know, said, I mean, it's not rocket science to say, hey, you know, you don't take nearly as many shots as you give up. Like, basically all we've done is quantify common sense, right? And
yeah.
I think we've known that's a bad idea for a long time. So, yes, I do think it's you got to look at it a little more, or especially early on when you're still trying to predict, you know, read the tea leaves and see where things are going to go.
Yeah, so in that sense, have you seen an improvement in this Maple Leafs team? If you're looking at just, you know, not just the wins, like, are you seeing the same things that I'm seeing, especially in those games against Tampa and Detroit? And, you know, even in the loss you mentioned against Pittsburgh and the overtime loss against the Penguins as well, are you seeing an improved commitment to puck possession from this team?
I think the Leafs are creeping toward being a more consistent team and a more, you know, having a more even performances. Yes, it's, you look at their wins. It's not like Jonathan Bernier is kicking out an endless barrage of shots. That's not really the case. I mean, like all teams, they need their goalie to be good.
I think he's been worse than he was last year.
Yeah, I think he has too. I agree. I don't have his save percentage right in front of me, but I bet it's a little worse than it was last year. And you know, I think no one's going to look at their six defensemen at the moment and say, well, you know, that's a extremely encouraging group. But yes, I do think the Leafs are moving toward becoming the kind of team that you know what to expect a little bit more from night to night. And big picture, that should certainly be their goal.
The one thing I would say about Jonathan Bernier, and I do have the numbers in front of me. I have the benefit of being in front of a computer. 912 save percentage as opposed to 923 from a year ago. But I believe his 5-on-5 numbers are much better than 9-12. The one thing that is concerning, and you saw it again in the Devils game, allowing a goal in the opening 5 minutes. That's happened 8 times this year to Jonathan Bernier. And he has, I mean, it's not just, I mean, that can be a fluky thing. I mean, it's not always a crappy goal. And certainly it's hard to fault him on that one against the Devils because it was deflected, really had no chance. But there is a thing, I think, happening with Jonathan Bernier. It was happening at the beginning of last year, even when he was playing well. He has the knack for allowing the occasional soft goal. You can make up for it if you're stopping, you know, if that's the one of 39 shots on goal that you're not allowing and it's a crappy goal, you can definitely get by with that. But there is, I think, something to that he has a knack for, especially early in a game, allowing a lousy goal. But it's also telling that they're going right back to him. No James Reimer, where you thought maybe after a kind of a mediocre game on Thursday, maybe you go to Reimer, give Bernier a bit of a break. Seems like, Ben, we've really gotten away from the 1A, 1B thing. It is Jonathan Bernier 1, James Reimer backup.
Yeah, and I think that Bernier's performance has justified that to this point in the season. It's interesting. I mean, you mentioned the soft goals, and I wonder, is that something that's really a concern for the Leafs, or do you kind of just look at the overall body of work and say, well, hey, he's preventing enough goals that we don't really care whether they're soft ones or whether they're amazing breakaways that are completely deserved.
Not to bring it back to baseball, but let's bring it back to baseball. Say you're a shortstop and you make a ton of spectacular plays, but you make the occasional stupid error. I feel like that's where we're at with Jonathan Bernier, where he'll let one go right through the wickets, but the number of spectacular plays to his left and right kind of makes up for it.
And I think as a fan, if you're watching, let's say, Johnny Peralta, insanely steady player, he's going to make everything that's hit in his direction. That's very reassuring. But if you have someone who's all over the place and they're maybe making amazing grabs but dropping the ball, that's so frustrating as a fan. So I think that maybe that would relate here to Bernier, because if you see that easy goal go in, you're just sitting there thinking, how could that possibly get past you?
Yeah, but so far, so good for Bernier. And I think a clear sign, obviously, that he's going to make yet another start tonight against the Vancouver Canucks. So we look at the offseason moves. You mentioned it, Ryan, that they were kind of under the radar. There was no big name. They didn't blow their brains out on another David Clarkson. And I think a lot of people did applaud them at the time that they didn't go out and overspend on a lousy free agent market. They didn't do that. They went out and got guys who could pay off. I think a lot of people looked at that Mike Santorelli signing and said, man, in a shortened season with the Canucks, put up some pretty good point totals. If you could extrapolate that over a full 82-game season, you might have something. You might have this year's Mason Raymond, and so far so good, at least on that front.
Yeah, and I mean, when that second line is going, it adds so much to the Leafs. So, I mean, obviously, Lupul's had his issues staying in the lineup, but, you know, he's going now. He had a couple against Dallas on Tuesday. So, yeah, it's been a nice fit there with Santorelli on that line. And, you know, it was all those moves. Maybe you didn't get anything out of a couple guys, but really it was easy to see the logic behind them all. And yes, I mean, certainly thus far, especially when you look at Komarov's point totals, you wouldn't expect those to remain where they are. But yeah, I think you can expect that Santorelli will continue to be a somewhat productive member on that second line. And you know what? If he falls off, give David Booth a crack, because he's the other guy you could have circled in the offseason and said, yeah, this guy could be the new Mason Raymond. He could go out there and score, you know, between 19 and 23 goals. It was very easy to see the path to that happening. So while they weren't, you know, really headline-grabbing moves at the time, it wasn't too hard to see the rationale behind them.
Everybody's darling preseason is back. Brandon Cozen, after a little conditioning stint with the Marlies, recalled to the Maple Leafs. He's at the pregame skate today. If he gets in, I guess he just gets slotted back onto that fourth line. He was playing some pretty good hockey, especially on the penalty kill early in the season before he got hurt. That's another, I mean, you talk about this team being as deep four lines as I can remember in the last decade almost. If you throw him in there and a guy like Richard Panik comes out, who's actually been pretty good in limited minutes as well. I mean, you're looking at just adding a little more depth to this team.
Yeah, and you know, you can't say enough about having fast guys like that on your fourth line. I remember back in the summer for the NHL preview, I was doing a story on the sort of back and forth between Los Angeles and Chicago. The two teams obviously have been at the absolute top of the table. And the Chicago's assistant GM, Norm McIver, was saying to me that they felt like The reason they beat LA in 2013 was because they still had guys like Michael Frolik around and Victor Stolberg, who, you know, they're not guys who are going to fill the net, but man, they can fly. And then they, you know, they lost a couple of those guys, and lo and behold, LA got a little quicker, and it you know, flipped the table. So, you know, when you can put a guy out there like Kozin, yeah, he's probably never going to get you a boatload of goals, but once in a while, that speed is going to create something. So in those 9-10 minutes a night he's going to get, or a guy like Panic, you know, they can still keep opponents on their heels. So as long as they're, you know, playing a responsible, clean game and not hurting you defensively, I mean, having those guys out there who can really fly, yeah, it's usually a good thing.
One of the talking points people enjoy about this Maple Leafs team, actually, I don't know if they enjoy it, but one of the talking points that at least exists on Twitter the last couple of weeks, and actually maybe for as long as these two guys have been on the team, is comparing Nazem Kadri to Tyler Bozak, who's the true number one center on this Maple Leafs team, and Bozak doesn't deserve to be there on that top line, and the only reason he produces the points he does is because he plays alongside Phil Kessel, and those guys are just buddy-buddy, and it's just a weird thing. But if you really wanted to get the most out of this team, you'd put Nazem Kadri out there, who's actually produced better results 5-on-5 in limited minutes this year. What are your thoughts on that when you look at the two teams? And certainly, Bozak isn't exactly a darling of the analytics community. Is he, in your opinion, deserving of that number one, true number one center status in the National Hockey League?
No, but there's only a very limited number of guys who actually, you know, live up to that or deserve that billing. The same as there's, you know, there isn't 30 number one defensemen. There isn't 30 number one centers. There's probably 10 number one centers and, you know, about the same defensemen. So when I look at the Leafs lineup, I don't think, oh, well, if you just flipped Kadri and Bozak, they'd be so much further ahead.
Yeah,
it's balance. And I think we can safely say at this point that Tyler Bozak between Phil Kessel and James Van Riemsdyk, well, that creates some offense. And so if you've got, you know, just say for the sake of argument that Kadri is a better offensive player than Tyler Bozak, well, then your second line's getting buoyed. And maybe Mike Santorelli, instead of being a 11-goal guy, is going to be a 21-goal guy. I mean, does Phil Kessel need a really good center to carry him around the ice? I don't think Tyler Bozak, you know, is an albatross to those guys by any stretch of the imagination. So I think the lineup as it's presently constructed works for Toronto. I don't see a huge need to flip those players because it's not necessarily about putting your three best players together to form a line.
And isn't it a good thing too that we can even have this discussion where there are two legitimate cases to be made as to who that top center would be? I mean, I'm not sure that would have been the case every year for the past few years.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a case when Tyler Bozak was injured last year, certainly. And Nazem Kadri has had his moment, not this year with the top line, but last year he had a pretty good swath of games, I want to say 3 or 4, and it really just didn't come together for him for whatever reason. He didn't have the chemistry. The goals were not coming off the sticks of Phil Kessel and James Van Riemsdyk when Nazem Kadri was in the middle of those two. And it seems like he does have something going on with Joffrey Lupul on that second line, who's a big reinsertion into this lineup. How much does he change the dynamic of this team now that he's healthy again?
I think a lot. I mean, when Lupul's going, you're looking at a guy who's creeping toward a 30-goal pace, right? I mean, that's a big threat to have on your second line, and we talked about it. You know, that top line, I think you can go out there and bank on them getting some goals at this point. It's pretty well established that those guys can create some offense. So when you got a second line now, I mean, if you've got Kadri getting toward being even a 55 point guy, and you know, obviously the thing with Kadri too is he does have such good hands. He is the kind of player who, even if he's kind of floated through a game, he can create something quick, and Lupul can finish. So it makes a huge difference to have that second line. That's what, you know, all NHL teams are striving to have, you know, at least two lines that you can reasonably count on for goals.
This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Ben Nicholson-Smith. Leafs host the Canucks tonight down at the Air Canada Center. 5 o'clock, Leafs Nation, Hockey Nation at 5 o'clock on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. 7 o'clock, puck drop on this radio station and CBC. Randy Carlyle is still the head coach of this team. It was a situation that you thought might not be the case after you mentioned those back-to-back losses where you get outscored 15-4 in Buffalo and then at home to Nashville. But there was no overreaction where maybe in years past there would have been. It was about as ugly as you're going to get in a city that is hockey mad, especially after you stop saluting the fans and whatever. Randy Carlyle is still the head coach of this team. He has seemingly turned over a new leaf, especially when it comes to those fourth line guys, right? Like there's no face punchers, whether he was forced into it or whether he has actually come along with the idea that you don't need to have some physical bruiser on that fourth line. Randy Carlyle seems to have at least changed his mentality. And maybe it's the two assistant coaches that were definitely forced upon him this season. But Ben, when you look at the future of this team and where they go next year, of course, there's the specter of Mike Babcock still hanging over everything. And it always will. And it'll get back into the focus of the media again on Wednesday when they head to Detroit and at home against the Red Wings on Hockey Night in Canada as well. Hard to argue with the job Randy Carlyle's done this year, though.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at the results, and that's from a step back, that's really all you can go off of. This is a team, like Ryan said off the top, that has basically played according to expectations. They're in that playoff mix, and they've had some really good things happen this year. So I think, if anything, we can look to this season and say, when things are going badly, Carlyle is going to feel the heat. That is not going to change. And if they get to the playoffs and disappoint there or fall short of the playoffs, he's going to feel the heat again. That's an inevitability in this market. And I think with him in particular. But to this point, hey, he's got them in the mix, and I think that's about where they should be.
Is there anything he can do to stave off Mike Babcock this offseason, Ryan?
Get to the second round. I think if he makes it to the second round, it's going to be tough to fire him.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where you don't see it very often where even if the move still makes sense, if someone has just recently taken a team further than they've been in a long time, could you really see them stepping in and letting Randy Carlyle go if the Leafs, you know, go to the seventh game of the second round and lose a tight one or something? Ultimately, I guess if you believe Mike Babcock is the best coach for your hockey team, even if Randy Carlyle takes him into the cup final, then you go get him. But I just don't see that happening. I'll say I don't have a real firm sense of whether Babcock will or won't stay in Detroit, but don't rule that out. He has a good thing going on
there. Why wouldn't he have signed already then?
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like the kind of thing where they could have got it done last summer. Maybe he did want to see, though, exactly where the team is at in terms of the Nyquists and Tatars of the world coming in, whether he believes that this is a team that can get back to the upper tier where it spent most of his time there. The Detroit Red Wings have been a really good team. They've regressed a little, obviously, but I'm not sure. I just know that, you know, it's to some degree, it's better to dance with the devil you know. And he's worked there a long time. He has a good relationship with Ken Holland. So I certainly don't think just because he hasn't signed yet that it's a foregone conclusion that he's putting himself on the open market and going to the highest bidder.
Speaking of head coaching changes and not overreacting, the Oilers have not overreacted, although some of their fans may have wished that they did something. But they've lost 11 in a row. Dead last in the Western Conference. They have not beaten a Western Conference opponent this season, which would be fine if, like, say, you played in a conference that wasn't the Western Conference. But that's kind of where they play. They play in the West. They haven't beaten an opponent in their own conference yet this season. Dallas Eakins has been worn down. Man, he hangs in there, though. The organization felt the need to actually communicate to not just its fans, but to the media yesterday, had an afternoon press conference in which Craig McTavish took questions. It was kind of weird, kind of threw some people under the bus. We'll talk about that. Also, look back at the life of Jean Béliveau, who passed away this past week. It's been kind of a bummer week for hockey fans, no question about it. We'll talk about all that coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Ben Nicholson-Smith on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet magazine, here's Jamie Doyle.
As a sports fan, when you look back, it's the moments you remember. That one hit, that one catch, that specific play you'll relive for years to come. So when it came time to hand out our fourth annual Sportsnet Awards for the best, worst, and most noteworthy from the year in sports, the choices boiled down to a collection of moments. Derek Jeter's career-ending walk-off single, Luis Suarez's World Cup biting attack, Richard Sherman's verbal smackdown of Michael Crabtree after the NFC Championship game. But one moment stands out above all, the women's Olympic hockey final. Canada trailing the United States 1-0 as time winds down, a Canadian defenseman is blocked off by the linesman at the U.S. blue line, allowing the Americans a long shot at Canada's empty net. If the puck goes in, it's all over. Canadians from coast to coast held their breath as the puck slid down the ice. Canadian players could only watch and wait, their gold medal dreams hanging in the balance as the puck hits the post. Canada would go on to win that game and the gold medal in overtime. But that moment, those agonizing seconds before the killer goal that wasn't, is what stands out. For more memorable moments from the past year in sports, check out the 2014 Sportsnet Awards.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet magazine, available on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand.
Sportsnet magazine, live Sportsnet radio network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Ryan Dixon and Ben Nicholson-Smith. Maple Leafs hockey coming your way, 5 o'clock, Hockey Nation. On Sportsnet 590, the Fan, Leafs and Canucks after 7 o'clock. The Canucks are the darlings of the Western Conference, and if they're the darlings, I don't know, what do you call the Oilers? What's the reverse of a darling? I don't know. The ugly stepchild of the Western Conference. They're bad. Again! One of these years, they're not going to be bad, I guess. Or maybe they're just paying penance for all those great teams in the 80s. They've lost 11 straight. They're 6-15-5. 17 points, dead last in the entire National Hockey League. Buffalo's actually playing a little bit better recently. But they're horrible. They have not beaten a team in the Western Conference. That's, I mean, almost impossible, you would think. They're 0-12-4. So they picked up 4 points. They've actually played some overtime games against the Jets recently and somebody else they went to overtime with as well. But they're horrible. They're going to have a high pick again. Whether it's number one is yet to be seen, but they've done a whole lot of that recently. And it's so bad, 11 straight losses, that I don't know if I've ever seen this, but the GM actually has to come out and address the situation without actually making a move. There was a lot of speculation that when Craig McTavish spoke to the media on Friday at 11 o'clock Eastern time, he was going to announce somebody was fired. Maybe the goalie coach again, or Dallas Eakins, or there was going to be some trade. Nope, none of that. Just took questions on his team's crappiness. It's harsh, man. Plus, you got to live in Edmonton through the winters. Ryan, yeah. Say something.
They need some warmth. There's no doubt about that.
What do they do?
You know what they have to do, and this is the crazy thing, and cover your ears, Oilers fans, but it actually doesn't matter that they've been bad for 8 years. They can't approach it that way. All they can do is look at the situation right now and address it as if they've just been bad for 5 minutes or 10 minutes, because ultimately you can't start making decisions based on the fact that, oh, well, in 07 and 08 and 09, we were really bad too. Doesn't really matter now. All that matters is you're in this hole, and whatever the best path to get you out of it is, you still have to take that. You can't amend the plan or try to expedite things just because things have gotten so gruesome and it's been so long. They just have to figure out the best way to start digging out. And the reality is there's no quick fix. It's just a crazy case study, right? Because I think especially us outside the game, the vast majority of us who watch sports but don't actually run teams are always quick to say, and I know in my own brain, and I can give you a couple examples right there in Western Canada with Calgary and even Vancouver, you think you got to draft high. Not that that's the panacea, but it always seems like especially now in the NHL where you can't get great players on the free agent market, especially young ones. It seems
you can't trade for them either.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like that is the one way you can get them. And it is kind of true. And I would say if you're going to be kind of bad, be really bad. But by the same token, what you see with Edmonton is the value of drafting beyond the first round. And, you know, Craig McTavish touched on it, slash threw the old regime under the bus. But, I mean, look at a team like the Boston Bruins. They won the Cup in 2011. They went to the final in 2013. Patrice Bergeron, Brad Marchand, Milan Lucic, David Krejci, all those guys, those core guys are second, and Krejci might even be a third rounder. You have to be able to fill your team out, or in that case, more or less build your team with draft picks that fall outside the first round. And Edmonton has just been terrible at that. So, I mean, the crazy thing too is, and I'm all over the place here, but you look at Edmonton, you look at Columbus. Columbus, which I was definitely on board with last year, and, you know, they've been decimated with injury. The Oilers, as bad as things have been, it is crazy to think that they both those teams could start next season with a Jack Eichel or Connor McDavid in their lineup, given what they already have, i.e. the Oilers could actually go, you know, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, who I still think is going to become a really good NHL center, a really good one, and let's just give them Eichel. And then you look at Columbus, and they've got the breakout player of last year, Ryan Johansson, who is a beast. And then let's just say you throw Connor McDavid in there. It's absolutely nuts. So, I mean, in terms of what the Oilers are going to do here, To some degree, I respect the fact that McTavish won't pull the trigger on Dallas Eakins. It's kind of refreshing. But you do wonder if Bob Nicholson, who was brought in there, you know, as the man sort of at the top of the hockey operations after being there for a long time, after being at Hockey Canada for a long time. I mean, the cronyism within the Oilers organization has been staggering. And you do wonder if someone's just got to, in one fell swoop, say, almost go to the other extreme and say, if you ever had anything to do with the Oilers at any time in your professional hockey career, management, whatever, we don't want you. We want to start again. We want to go out there and hire some new bright minds because it just hasn't been working. And they keep going to guys, you know, McTavish was obviously the coach the last time they made the final. You know, it just seems like they need to expand their horizons in terms of the people they've been willing to hire. But I don't know, you know, McTavish, again, to some degree, you got to give him credit for not making the trade where his knees have buckled. And he says, well, we got to get rid of one of these guys because, you know, the pitchforks are sort of the fans' pitchforks are at the door, and, you know, the GMs are sniffing around going, what can we make off with here? Right. So, the last thing you want to do is create an even bigger problem by trading one of your good players for three guys who actually aren't that good.
Well, that's the thing. There's two extreme ends of this. There's the, you just got to make a trade because everybody says we got to give up one of these guys and we need something on the back end or we need a goalie. So, I mean, we got to give up one of our pieces and you end up getting less than you should for one of these great pieces because your team is so crappy. But there's also the other side of it where you can overvalue your assets as well and holding on to them. I mean, we see, okay, maybe I shouldn't keep bringing it back to baseball, but I want to. The Phillies, you know, they overvalued all these pieces. They didn't deal any of them away and they have nothing to show for it. They're going to be lousy again this year because they overvalued the pieces that they have. Is it possible that this is also happening in Edmonton?
I think the difference there is it was almost like the Phillies were showing loyalty to old guys who had carried them to the promised land. Whereas in Edmonton, they are still, you know, I think you know what you got with Taylor Hall. You got a really good dynamic scoring winger. Like I said, Nugent Hopkins, he's been banged up. You know, maybe he's not that first overall pick that some people thought, but I'm still in the camp that I wouldn't be willing to give up on him. And, you know, the ultimate example is probably Yakupov, their 2012 first overall pick, who's, you know, he scored some goals, but it certainly hasn't really meshed there. He's the guy who keeps getting circles. It looks like he's the odd man out, but, you know, he's the guy who's going to fetch the least and still probably has the most to show somewhere else. So, you know, God help you if after all this you trade Nail Yakupov for a third and fourth defenseman and he turns around and puts 41 goals up somewhere, you know? So, it's tough. I think that's why they're still reticent. But, I mean, they have such such a collection of guys who either are for sure talented up front or figure to be talented up front, including Draisaitl, who they drafted last year. You know, it's just a matter of finding that partner where you have different needs. The problem is, I don't think there's a team at Edmonton's position around the league. Like, there's no team that's saying, well, we just have four really great defensemen and we desperately need score. You know what I mean? There just isn't that
young
match.
Forward.
Yeah. I mean, sure, there's a lot of teams that will take your young forward off your hands, but they're probably not in a position to say, here is a guy who can go be a lights out 22 minutes a night, number two defenseman, lock it down. You know, if they have that guy, they need him. So they're not going to get rid of him.
Right. It's not like the Maple Leafs are going to trade Morgan Rielly for Nail Yakupov.
That's right.
Yeah, it's just not going to happen. And you can see what young, good defensemen can do for a team, because you don't have to go very far to look at the Calgary Flames, and that's exactly what they've done.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, the Flames, for a team that I and any number of people thought were going to be absolutely in the Connor McDavid sweepstakes, and that was great for them, because, you know, of course, the cruel joke if you're from Northern Alberta and an Oilers fan is, while it seemed like the Oilers were doing this the quote-unquote right way by drafting high, there's Calgary clinging to old glory, hanging on to Jerome Iginla for too long. And lo and behold, they've turned a corner pretty quickly. Sure, people are going to poke holes in where they are in the standings, but there's no denying that, you know, Johnny Gaudreau, okay, you know, maybe this is an aberration, but it sure looks like he's going to be a guy who goes out there and gets some points. He was, I think, a fifth-round pick. You look at the defense, TJ Brody, I mean, a third-rounder who's just turned into an absolute gem, and he's playing on a defense pair with Mark Giordano, who wins the Norris Trophy if the vote is tomorrow, and a guy who's flown under the radar for a lot of years, and now all of a sudden, at the center of this rebuild, Calgary has a defense pair that any team competing for the Stanley Cup would be happy to have, so... You know, exactly where the Flames are going the rest of the way, I think you can debate a little bit, but I'm not one of the people who thinks the bottom is going to fall out. I don't think they're going to lose, you know, 8 of their next 10. Jonas Hiller's been a good goalie in the NHL at different times. It is not a shock to see him playing consistently good. Kari Ramo, you know, Calgary made a great trade to pick him up as a throw-in when they got rid of Rene Bork to Montreal a couple years ago. You know, you find these guys off the scrap heap late in the draft, and, you know, you roll it all together, and things are pretty good. And Calgary's been bad enough the last couple of years that they have gone to near the top of the draft, and they've drafted Sam Bennett, and they've drafted Sean Monahan. You know, there's every reason to believe that those two guys will be good centers the rest of the way, and, you know, they've pieced enough things together, and they play hard for Bob Hartley. And they are making the Oilers look terrible, no doubt.
How frustrating must that be for Oilers fans, Ben? I mean, you look at what's gone on in Calgary, and they were supposed to be in the dumper, and you were supposed to take that one step forward to being a team that can battle for a playoff spot, and it's gone completely against script.
It's got to be awful. I one of my good friends is an Oilers fan, and she has this Oilers toque. Loves the toque, orange and blue, great looking toque. But she no longer wears it because she gets too much trash.
You're gonna say she threw it on the ice?
No. But it's so easy to hate on the Oilers right now. And you know, maybe it comes down to that offense defense thing. I mean, you've got to keep goals out of the net. And it sounds, Ryan, like, you know, Calgary is really good with that defensive pairing at keeping pucks from going in.
Yeah, they're, I mean, certainly miles ahead of the Oilers.
But how much, I mean, if you put a good to an average to above average goaltender on that Edmonton Oilers team, they're not where Calgary is, but certainly they're not, you know, have they lost 11 in a row? Are they winless against the Western Conference? How much of this does come down to goaltending?
I certainly think they would benefit from more consistent and better goaltending, but you know, that defense has been a mess for years too. So, I mean, it's tough to fully throw the goalies under the bus, and to have a pair like Giordano and Brody that you can rely on for 25 minutes a night, that is a dream for Edmonton. So, you work from the forwards back. Everything that is in the forwards, Calgary is certainly outshining Edmonton, no doubt.
It was a tough week for the hockey community. This country and the world as a whole, as Jean Béliveau passes away. He was hockey in Montreal there for a long time alongside Maurice Richard. You really can't find anybody to say a negative thing about him. The word classy is almost gone and become synonymous with his name, and it has been throughout his career. You talk to anyone that's ever met him, it seems like they have a great story to tell. And Gear Joyce isn't on today's program, but I know, Ryan, you got a chance to talk to him about his interaction with Jean Béliveau.
Yeah, and if you have a chance, go to sportsnet.ca and read Gear's obit. He interviewed Béliveau when Béliveau was promoting his book a number of years ago. So Gear was late to the scheduled interview and felt like he owed an explanation and said, you know, well, actually my father-in-law is battling cancer and he's really sick. Béliveau picks up the phone and says, what's his number? Gives him a call and got the answering machine. So he, you know, left a nice message. So in the course of talking to Jean about his book, you know, it comes to light that unlike many athletes, which is, you know, it's their, this, the normal approach is that they would usually sit down with a writer and do a series of interviews. And, you know, essentially the writer pieces together the book, works with the athlete, but, you know, certainly the athlete isn't spending hours upon hours in front of the computer, hacking it out. Jean Béliveau spent a year writing out his biography in longhand. So, I mean, that just shows you the care. And at the end of the interview, he picked up the phone and called Gear's father-in-law again. So just, you know, the word class has been stripped of all meaning, I think, in the hockey world, maybe sports world, because, you know, it's a classy move when someone decides to fight someone because the guy deserved a chance or whatever. Silly things like this. I mean, the word class should be reserved for somebody like Jean Béliveau, who, you know, I think he just held himself to a higher standard. And that's the way he carried himself. That's the way he lived his life.
It's, I mean, and you can't overstate this either. I mean, he played on 10 Stanley Cup winners and won another 7 as an executive. 17 Stanley Cup wins for Jean Béliveau. I mean, that's never going to happen again.
Well, can you imagine saying, I played 20 years in the league and I won the Stanley Cup 50% of the time I played, you know? I mean, it speaks a little bit to the six-team league. It speaks a lot to the six-team league. But yeah, it's absolutely absurd. Jean Béliveau is truly that one where all the hyperbole is justified. He was a really, really integrity-filled man who just, you know, and best, my actually favorite little nugget about Jean Béliveau, I believe, was true all the way through. He was in the phone book his whole
life.
That's
right.
You could look up his phone number if you really wanted to. But no one would dare, you know, overstep because of the respect he had.
Yeah, and it's... Stephen Brunt's essay on Sportsnet was spectacular as well. And I love the fact that, yes, he held out from the Montreal Canadiens because he was playing in the QJHL, and the Canadiens wanted him so bad they bought the league.
Yeah.
And ended his career in Quebec. So, yes, our thoughts are with the Béliveau family, one of the greats of all time. Gents, thanks a lot for this. It's been great.
My pleasure.
Fun. Thank you.
That'll do it for Sportsnet Magazine Live. Coming up next, I got an hour of Sportsnet today. I'm Ben Ennis. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live with Ryan Dixon and Ben Nicholson-Smith on the Sportsnet Radio Network.